welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. And that snippet I opened the show with tonight was a little bit of Arms of the Mother by one of my favorite artists, Abigail Spinner McBride, out of Las Vegas. Well, if you're new to the show, I'm your hostess, Karen Tate, and I'm the author of two acclaimed books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and its bookend, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. One tells about the many different types of sanctuaries of goddess on Mother Earth, whether it be woman's business in Australia or archaeological sites or churches or places of natural beauty and art. And my second book, it's sort of a template for a solitary or a group to embrace the divine feminine and live a goddess-inspired life, whether you're looking at it from the perspective of deity, archetype, or ideal. So I hope you'll check out my website, KarenTate.com, and learn more about my work. And while you're there, please take advantage of the free downloadable meditations. They're my gift to you. Well, tonight I have two wonderful guests. We're going to start at the top of the hour with Professor Doug Cohen. He's a professor of religious studies at Renison University College and the University of Waterloo. And our subject is going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be talking about his most recent book titled Sacred Space, The Quest for Transcendence and Sci-Fi Film and Television. We're going to get into Stargate and Star Wars and Avatar and, I'm trying to think, the movie with the Cylons. I'm drawing a blank right now. And then after we chat with Doug, we're going to have returning to the show. We haven't had her here in way too long. Mama Donna, or Donna Hennis. She's an internationally renowned urban shaman, eco-ceremonialist, a ritual expert, spiritual counselor, award-winning writer, popular speaker, and workshop leader. And we're going to be talking about A Woman's Guide to Power, Claim It, Embrace It, and Use It. So I am going to just check and see if this is Doug on the line. I think we were having some phone problems a minute ago. So just one second. Hey, Doug, is that you?
Yeah, I'm here. I was busy just babbling away, but you were gone. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I could hear you, but you couldn't hear me. So I'm glad I'm glad you called back. Thank you so much.
We just reconnected. I didn't call back.
Oh,
we're
okay.
Good.
All right, good, good. Well, hopefully that won't happen again. It rarely does. So, we can, get started with our chat here. We actually sort of started off the air. So let's start at the beginning, though, for the benefit of our listeners.
Sure.
Why don't we start with what you mean by transcendence when you reference that in your book, Sacred Space, The Quest for Transcendence in Sci-Fi Film and Television?
Well, one of the things about the way science fiction has been looked at a lot is people have dismissed what I would call the religious aspect of it. They say, well, because we have science, then religion really doesn't have much of a place. So you have a few episodes of the original series of Star Trek, for example, and people point out that, oh, look at that, Captain Kirk finds out they're not really gods. Therefore, that means that religion is really kind of, you know, stupid and retrograde and backwards, and really, we really should move forwards. And I wanted to get away when I started writing about religion in science fiction because, I mean, the title could easily have been The Religious Quest, but I kind of wanted to get away from the valence that the word religion has. Now, that transcendence kind of said it a little bit better because, you know, transcendence occurs in a lot of different ways. Some people, when they think about transcendence, they say, you know, they think of the transcendent. And by that, they mean some sort of God figure or deity figure or ultimate reality, something like that, something that is beyond and utterly alien to but related to us in some way.
Something
I guess that's
supernatural,
one way you can think about
something
it.
Not human. You know, something
Sorry?
That's beyond our – something supernatural, not human.
Yeah. Yeah,
right.
Because, you know, I mean, when you think about even, you know, like you take the, you know, the Christian understanding of God, for example, which is, you know, should come into our conversation at some point. You know, this is a being that even if you take the text exactly as written, is utterly alien to us. I mean, utterly unlike us, utterly transcendent to
mm-hmm.
who we are. So
right.
that's one way of thinking about it. But I think that that's a kind of a, if that's the only way we think about it, I think it's a little bit limited.
Yeah.
Because there's also, you know, the transcendence of boundaries. And I think that's what I'm really interested in. Because when you think about films that involve robots, for example, what we see over the last 40 or 50 years, if you think about 2001, A Space Odyssey, with HAL, right?
Right.
I mean, some of the most scariest words ever spoken in a science fiction movie were, "I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that." Right? When Dave Bowman wants to come back inside
right,
the ship,
right,
and the
right.
computer says, he says, "Open the pod bay doors, HAL." And HAL says, "I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that."
We've lost control.
Yeah. But what's going on, and if you actually read a lot of the commentary about that, you know, you read all kinds of people who say, well, HAL's just evil. Well, no. He just can't transcend his own programming.
Right.
He was programmed to do a certain thing, and he wasn't able to transcend that. So that's one way of thinking about it. Then you take a movie like iRobot, which, you know, was a big action, you know, vehicle for Will Smith, but it has these wonderful, wonderful moments in it where we watch as another creation, another race of beings, if you will, starts to transcend their own sense of being. And there's this great line. It's almost lost in all the shooting and car wrecks and things like that, but it's when the Professor Lanning, the guy who creates these robots, creates Sonny, the robot who says, "They all look not like me, but they're not me." Right? The sense of individuality.
Yeah.
And there's this voiceover. And he says, I'm paraphrasing, but I'm close. He says, "Why is it when robots are put together in a dark room, they will seek out the light? Why is it when robots are gathered together in a space, they will stand together rather than alone? Why is that?"
So was he,
you know,
talking about
asking,
they were more human than we thought?
Well, at the very end, he started, not more human, because, you know, that's sort of, you know, we judge everything according to what we think is consciousness.
Yeah.
But at the very end, he says, you know, when does a perceptual schematic become consciousness?
Hmm.
When does a program routine become the bitter mote of a soul? Now, that's a beautiful line. The bitter mote of a, I mean, a mote's like a little piece of dust.
Right.
And when you, what is it? A little piece of grit that is bitter inside of an oyster. It's what produces a pearl.
Well, and didn't Brent Spiner, the guy who played on Star Trek, you know,
Data. Lieutenant Commander Data.
It's sort of the same thing, you know. He was
exploring. He was the one who was always trying to transcend his program because his neural network allowed him to learn, and he was always the one who showed everybody else on that show their own humanity.
Hmm.
I mean, he kept a pet to learn. He kept Spot the cat.
Right.
To learn, so he could learn about caring. But if you know, the way I watch these things is I watch the entire series from beginning to end without stopping. I mean, you know, over several days. Because then you get the story arcs.
Yeah.
Right? You start
yeah.
to see the connections rather than forgetting them. And, you know, it's not so much in the series with Data, because he's a really interesting character and one of the most beloved in the Star Trek universe. It's in actually the film First Contact, when they go back in time to escape the Borg and prevent the Borg from taking over Earth. That's when Data is captured by the Borg Queen, who's played by Alice Krieg, brilliantly, I might add. And she replaces a piece of his skin with sort of synthetic skin, so that you can actually feel what it feel what skin feels, feel what we would feel. And it's
was,
this wonderful.
Was she tempting him?
It's exactly. What she wants him to do is to sort of come and be her king, to be her board king. And he, you know, so he's the one thing that is his temptation, he actually turns his back on so that he can rescue his friends.
Right.
There's all this stuff going on. Then you've got, you go from something like that, you go to a film like Steven Spielberg's AI. Right?
Now that one I didn't see. Yeah, I didn't see that one.
Well, basically, it's Pinocchio.
Okay.
It's basically an updated version of Pinocchio, because the whole story is about these robot children who are so lifelike that the idea is the people with whom they are placed and on whom they imprint will come very quickly, in fact, to forget that they are machines.
Hmm.
So all of this together, when you take that arc, what I would call an arc of transcendence, you see different stopping points, little different snapshots along the sort of the science fiction journey of what happens when the machines we create begin to transcend that for which they were created.
Well, that was a lot of the theme in the Battlestar Galactica, too, wasn't it,
with
the Cylons that were human?
Absolutely. That was completely the theme. And then they, in fact, the Cylons, went it one better when they invented the second generation of Cylons who couldn't be told apart from us.
Right.
Right? And then, you know, there's a whole business with the Final Five. Who are the Final Five? They didn't even know they were Cylons.
Well, and I liked it in the Battlestar Galactica 2 on the idea of religion,
Oh, you've lost me. I hope you can hear me because I can't hear you. Okay, Karen, I'm going to try and call back in.
Doug is back. Let's see. Doug, are you there? Hang on. Doug, are you there? Hang on just a second. Doug, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah. I can hear you.
Okay.
I'm not sure what's going on tonight. I've never had this happen before. Are you using Skype or something? Or
no, just my normal phone.
Okay, all right. Well, I apologize. Well, anyway,
that's
we
right.
were talking. Are you still hearing me?
Yep.
Okay, we were talking about Battlestar Galactica, and I was about to talk to you about that theme that started to, I guess you'd call it a story arc, that started to come up where the human fella, you know, people started to look at him like he was the Messiah or God.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was a really interesting...
Gaius Baltar.
Yes, Gaius Baltar. What did you think about that character and that theme that ran through?
I think that, I mean, it was interesting. It was sort of the, it was kind of an obvious arc, if you will. It's sort of my other academic interest is new religious movements. So I'm pretty familiar with how these emerge and how they sort of come to be. And that was a pretty good example of how new religions emerge out of tension and crisis.
Well, and here I was thinking it was like, you know, monotheism coming into, sort of doing away with paganism and monotheism taking center stage.
Well, you know, that's sort of the way a lot of people read the whole Cylon god versus sort of Romanish, Greekish gods of the human population. But I sort of look at that as, okay, that's the obvious part, but surely there's other questions we can ask than that, because if that's the question that we ask, and this is one of the things I'm always pushing my students on, is, okay, if that's the question that we ask, how much more do we know at the end of it?
Not much, probably.
Right? That makes sense. Yeah, exactly. Not much. But what it does is it gives us a real nice platform to ask other questions. Like, well, okay, in the context of this sort of missionary enterprise that the Cylons have to sort of convert or kill, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which gets played out very, very differently throughout the series according to different characters' interpretations. Right, you got the great Dean Stockwell character. He just wants to kill everybody.
Right,
but then you've got the Sixes, who are always at odds with things, or the Three. She played Xena, warrior princess.
Yeah, I remember her.
Yeah, you know who I mean. They come into this. They're asking very, very different questions. Like, what does the Opera House mean for us?
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay. God wants us to do this. Well, what does God want us to do? Does God want us really to go and kill all these people? Why can't we live together? Well, we can't live together because we're different. Well, what if we can live together? Why can't we ask different questions? I mean, this is what's at the heart of what's going on with the Cylons, is why can't we ask different questions? Not why do we have all the same answers.
Right.
Why can't, I mean, when, because what happens in one episode is when the Three, the Deanna Three, she keeps committing suicide?
Yes.
She keeps committing suicide because she's trying to find out what's on the other side. She's trying. I mean, it's the classic religious quest. I want to know what's on the other side of death. I want to know what the Bardo state, right? The between state between death and rebirth, between getting shot in the head by a Cylon, by one of my own, and coming back to life on the resurrection ship. I want to know what's in between that, right? And that's a classic religious quest. That's a classic quest for transcendence.
Absolutely.
For asking a different question. And what does, pardon me, the Dean Stockwell, which I think is a four maybe, what does the Dean Stockwell character say to her? He says, you can't ask those questions. That makes you a heretic. You can't ask questions about the final five. We're not allowed to know. It's not about the answers you get. You're not even allowed to ask the questions. So what we have is we have these other themes, like religious control, clerical control, religion as social control. What happens when religion goes off the rails a little bit, like with Gaius Baltar?
Right.
Which brings us to another question of, okay, who's to say it's off the rails? Because that's one of the things that is sort of a pet peeve of mine in the way of a lot of religion and science fiction has been interpreted, is people take what they think or they understand to be their own religion, they map it onto a television series or a movie, they see something that doesn't fit, and they point their finger and they go, aha, that's a false religion. Well, not to the people who were involved.
I'm trying to think about that in terms of how I was watching Stargate, and when they brought out all the Norse gods, and I can't even remember all of them now because it's been too long ago. But I remember so enjoying that because I thought, wow, they are really, you know, they've really done their homework here in a lot of cases. You know, they're showing how maybe some sort of being, for lack of a better word, could have evolved into these myths of gods, like maybe where our mythology came from. It felt like they, it just wasn't the normal stuff, it felt like they had, really mined some fresh material, or at least it did to me.
Let me tell you where the fresh material came from.
Okay.
Because I love Stargate.
Yeah.
I'm a complete Stargate fan. I mean, if I'm going to be stranded on an ice planet, I want it to be with Amanda Tapping. But you remember that episode?
She'll protect you.
Sorry?
She can rescue me.
I'm sorry?
She would be able to protect you.
That's right. That's what I'm looking for. But anyway, this is what I call the von Däniken paradox.
Okay.
Perhaps you're familiar with a Swiss writer called Erich von Däniken.
Oh, absolutely.
He wrote a little book called Chariots of the Gods, which was published in the mid 1960s. It's never been out of print. He's a millionaire many, many times over. And basically, what he argues in it, and he's not the only person. It's a very popular theory, the ancient astronaut theory. That basically he argues that all the major religions are the product of extraterrestrial visitation, Paleolithic extraterrestrial visitation. So aliens land, see a rather, a people very early in development. They have no idea what a person from another planet is, no idea what another planet is. But they see this person or this being, and they start to revere it as gods. Well, von Däniken, what he did in Chariots of the Gods, he sort of challenged all kinds of accepted cosmology and archaeology and astronomy. And a lot of it is really very, very problematic. I mean, he's been debunked over and over and over. But what I was fascinated when I started looking at Stargate, as soon as I started watching it, I said, this is von Däniken. The gods really are aliens.
Mm-hmm,
Ra,
mm-hmm.
All the Norse gods. Now, you never see Allah.
No.
You never see
Allah.
That's a little bit too close to the bone.
Yeah,
but
it
you
would
do
be.
See an awful lot. You see Etruscan gods.
Yeah.
In an episode called The Broca Divide.
Right.
You see basically an Etruscan kind of setting.
And you saw a lot of Egyptian motifs, too.
A lot of Egyptian gods. There were Chinese gods. There was one of the celestial emperors.
Yeah.
So you have all of these. And, of course, they're not gods at all. They are Gua'uld.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're Gua'uld.
Yes.
So when you read interpretations, it's like, oh, well, they're just false gods. Because they're just, what Jack O'Neill called snakeheads.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? What I want to do is say, okay, all right, that's fine. But what does that mean for the people who worship them? Like in the Broca Divide, when it's the SG-1 team that comes through the Stargate and are immediately treated as gods, right? What happens when they leave? Do you think that whole society is going to go, oh, well, I guess they weren't gods after all? I don't think so. Because religion is very, very resilient. Religion, I mean, one of the exercises I give to my students is I say, imagine somebody found the bones of Christ. I mean, irrefutably, right? They find they find a crypt, they find the bones, absolute proof there was never a physical resurrection. It's not in any doubt anymore. Do you think Christianity would just fold up its tents and go away?
No, they'd make up some excuse. Or they would
make up an excuse. They would reinterpret it.
Because
that's what religions do. And every religion does it. Every religion. There were a lot of modern pagans for a very long time who believed that Maria Gimbutas was actually correct about, the ancient goddess statues and things. That's been under fire for a very long time.
Right.
There was the
right.
whole issue of the burning times.
Right.
You know, 9 million women killed.
Right, well, right.
Matilda Gage made up that number in 1896. Right?
Okay.
So religions are very, very resilient. It's not that they make excuses for it. It's they take changes in situation, changes in data, and they continue the quest for transcendence. It's not like they go, oh, well, that quest didn't work. I better find another quest. It's not how humans do things. And one of the beautiful things about SG-1 is it illustrated this in so many different ways.
Well, and not to keep jumping around here, but you started to touch on something, and I took you down another path, and I want to go back to it a little bit. When we were talking about the what was his name, the character on Gaius Baltar. You said that it showed how sometimes religions are born out of what did you say? You said out
crisis.
Of a crisis.
They're born out of times of crisis.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, we have to ask what is the function of religion? I mean, I call fear and hope in the book, my book on horror, Sacred Terror, and Sacred Space. I call fear and hope the twin DNA, the intertwined DNA, the double helix of religion is fear and hope, because there are a lot of people, a lot of scholars, and I find their argument pretty persuasive. A lot of scholars believe that 100,000 years ago, 150,000 years ago, religion begins with this sense of fear. We begin to imagine things, we begin to create things, we begin to tell stories about things which explain to us how we survive in the face of basic existential fears like death and dying and famine and horrible things happening to us and thunder and lightning and all of that kind of thing. Now, it doesn't obviously stay that way, but if fear is one of the origins of religion, hope is one of the ends towards which it tends. So you have these two things which are always in tension. So if you have a time of great tension, often people will look for religious comfort. They may look for somebody who has an answer. You know, Gaius supposedly cured this little boy. I mean, this is one of the things, like a miracle story, right? The little boy is cured. I can't remember if he actually did anything or not, but the little boy. And then the woman goes, "You cured him." And then he goes into a cell for a while, and the stories about him start getting told. Hey, did you? Well, you know, he cured one of my kids too. I think he cured my uncle. And these stories get told and told and told. And then he gets released. It's like, you founded a religion after me. Holy crap! No pun intended.
Right.
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 Now it's very easy for us to sort of point our finger and chuckle and go, "Oh, those silly, stupid people. How absurd."
Well,
but
you think about the stories
again,
about
how
Jesus.
Much more do we know?
Right.
Sorry?
Well,
how much
well,
more
it
do
makes
we know?
It makes me think about the stories about Jesus.
Well, yeah,
you know,
the stories
all
about
of his
Jesus.
Miracles as well.
Sure, the stories about Jesus. There are all kinds of, I mean, religions begin in this way. This is one of the ways that religions begin. And I think that's why I keep coming back to this question, how much more do we know? If we only point out the really obvious things,
mm-hmm.
I don't really think we learn very much. And
yeah.
That's what I tried to do with both Sacred Space and Sacred Terror, is not push the answers, because these are just my answers. You know, people are free to accept them or not. But what I wanted to do is push the edge of the questions.
Okay.
What happens when robots become conscious? What moral obligation do we have to that which we have created, for example?
Hmm.
Right? What happens if, you know, we have no idea what our soul is. We barely have an idea what consciousness is. We know when we're conscious. But if you read a lot of, you know, cognitive scientists and you ask them to define consciousness, That's a very slippery animal indeed.
Well, and, I'm wondering if that new TV show, well, I mean, it's only been on one season so far. I think it's called Dark Skies, where the...
Oh, Dark Skies was, yeah, Dark Skies was actually 1998. It was Chris Carter trying to spin off the X-Files. And
oh,
it was,
okay.
You're absolutely right. It was only one season. It was the Roswell UFO cover-up myth.
All right, but isn't that the one where you know, the aliens are invading the planet, and then it looks like at the very end that these aliens are really being controlled by other aliens, so you wonder
That's right.
who's really the bad guy.
Yep.
And so anyway, I'm just wondering if that's going to sort of reveal itself to be you know, something along these lines as well.
Oh, I have no idea. You know, and that sounds like do I think there are aliens out there visiting the planet? That's where we get into, you know, the whole business of alien visitations. One of the things I write in the book is the day after first contact.
Yeah.
The world will end.
As we know
it. The world will end with first contact.
So why do you say that?
Well, the world as we know it will end.
Okay,
because
okay.
The day after first contact can never, ever look the same as the day just before.
Well, won't
because,
that rock the foundations of religion?
Well, it's interesting. There are a couple of people who have actually done studies on that. A woman named Victoria Alexander and a man named Ted Peters. They've both done what they call sort of colloquially the Anderson or Peters extraterrestrial religious crisis survey. And what they found is that, no, there are some people who are going to freak out about it, other people who are going to basically go about their business. Because if you read the SETI literature, and there's a pretty voluminous SETI literature on post-contact, you know, for the first few days, we're all going to be glued to our television sets, but eventually we're going to have to go back to work.
Right.
And get groceries and put gas in the car, and you're going to have to do your radio show, and I'm going to have to teach my classes. And when that starts to happen, there will be a normalization that takes place. There will be this initial wonder and panic from some people and crisis from others, and you know, I mean, of course it depends on how this contact happens, but eventually, and probably not very long after, things will attain a new normality. And that also means people will go back to church or synagogue or temple or circle or, you know, whatever they do. What I was interested in when I wrote about it in the book was there are basically three ways I see that science fiction offers us a vision, a glimpse into the way first contact will affect people. First is what I call millennium. Millennium is a word that is used to express a hope for the future, a positive sense of what's coming. So if you think about E.T., right, E.T.,
mm-hmm.
and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, right?
Right,
Steven Spielberg's two movies.
Right.
Those movies ask exactly the same question from opposite ends. In Close Encounters of the Third Kind, it's a massive, intentional group visitation that is made for the entire planet.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of looks at how societies respond.
Okay.
E.T. is an accidental contact. The poor little guy gets left behind. All he wanted was his plants, and he gets left behind. So it's how does an individual family deal with an individual contact. He's looking at exactly the same phenomenon, but as though through a telescope with one and a microscope with the other.
Okay.
But these are both very, very hopeful films.
Well, and also
E.T. is my wife's favorite movie. Sorry?
Well, Doug, the thing I'm thinking too, well, going back to your how would we respond to the contact, wouldn't it in great measure it'd be determined by what kind of contact it was?
Absolutely. It absolutely would. If we are attacked, that will be a very different contact.
Yeah, because then we're not going to be worried about teaching classes, radio shows, and getting gas.
No, maybe not. But if it is, for example, as it is in the film Contact, if it's like an electronic communication.
Yeah, like the Jodie Foster. That was Jodie Foster, right? Contact. Okay.
Right. All of a sudden, we are. It's first contact, but they haven't landed.
I see. Okay, and they haven't threatened us or anything, right?
Right. And then you've got, so you have this hopeful vision of the way first contact will go.
Right.
Then you have what I call apocalypse. These are the ones that I actually find frustrating and fascinating by terms. Apocalypse, of course, is like the end of the world, right? These are people that I call, and it's a $50 word, but I kind of like it, a $50 phrase, terracentric human exceptionalists. Fundamentalist Christians who believe quite passionately that humanity is the sole intelligent species in the entire universe. There is no other intelligent life in the entire universe. And that the only communication from the creator of the universe has come to this one group of people on this tiny speck of dust in a backwoods arm of a second-rate galaxy. Because that's basically what we are. Right? And the unutterable arrogance, it seems to me, that it takes to say we are alone. When you say, well, how do you know we're alone? How do you know? And there are films made about this, how do you know we're alone? Well, the Bible says we're alone. Oh, well, that just solves it then, doesn't it?
Well, don't you think the fundamentalist, if we would have some kind of contact, wouldn't they automatically jump to the conclusion it must be God?
I actually don't think so.
No?
I would suggest, given the reading that I've done, and I have shelves of their books, I think they have already, a lot of them write about the ET phenomenon, the UFO sightings, of the abduction phenomenon, things like that. And they're very clear that it is a spiritual reality, but it is not God. They are very clear that this is a sort of a satanic run-up to the end of days.
So what do they think is happening in these?
They think they're demons.
Just demons. I see.
Okay.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
So then you've got that. So you've got that. You've got the positives. You got the negatives. Positive, the ships will come someday. Positive, they won't come someday, because if they do, they'll be demons. And then you've got the X-Files, what I call ambivalence. This is the notion that maybe they've been here already. Because there's that great story arc in sort of season 6 and 7 of the X-Files, where Mulder is in one of his many comas, and Scully goes off to try and find something that can save him. And she winds up going to the west coast of Africa, the Côte d'Ivoire. And there she uncovers the wreckage of a spacecraft, which is covered, whose entire outer fuselage is covered with these symbols, which she translates as the complete human genome, for example. Passages from the Old Testament, passages from the Quran, passages from other religious myths.
Hello?
So the question is, what? Sorry?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
So the question there is, well, that's another way that science fiction raises up questions for us. And I don't know which one's right, but, what I'm trying to do with the book is push these kind of questions and say we can look deeper. And it's like I said, I think I may have said this to you before we went on air, but, you know, in The Matrix, right, mm-hmm. the most famous scene in The Matrix, aside from that bullet time shot of Trinity at the beginning,
yeah.
The most famous scene in The Matrix is Morpheus sitting with Neo before Neo has sort of come out of those banks of the goo that they were in. And he offers him two pills, right? He says, take the red pill, and I'll show you how far down the rabbit hole goes. Take the blue pill, you go back to your life. Well, I look at that, and I sort of agree with Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, who in his Pervert's Guide to the Cinema said, I want a third pill. So when people point at films and go, oh, look, there's a Jesus figure. Well, I want a third pill. To Jesus figure, I want something else. People look at Avatar, oh, well, that's just paganism. I want a third pill. I want to be able to ask different questions. Because I think that's where the future of looking at how film influences the way we think. I mean, I don't think we think about that a lot. When I taught in the U.S., I lived there for 5.5 years and taught in Kansas City, I used to regularly ask my students, who landed first on D-Day? Those of them who could remember, a lot of them said, well, we did. The Americans did. So really, how do you know that? Well, they made that movie about it. You know, Saving Private Ryan.
Right.
It wasn't the Americans. It was the Canadians and the British. But that's, people tend to forget. We have this thing, it's called source dissociation.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to forget where we learn things, especially things that we agree with.
Right.
So we hear something. We kind of attach to it, and we agree with it. And then when it comes up 6 months later in conversation, you go, oh, yeah, I remember that, blah, blah, blah. But we forget that it was in a movie that we saw.
Well, it makes me think of Oliver Stone's movie about the JFK assassination.
Sure.
You know, how things start to take on, they rewrite history. Or, for that matter, the fundamentalists trying to rewrite the history books in Texas. I don't know if you heard about that in Canada. But.
Oh, yeah. Norman Gabler. He's been going at that since about the mid-1960s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm very familiar with that. So, I mean, one of the things that I think is so incredible about science fiction and horror, by the way, one of the things I think is so incredible about science fiction is it's the genre that allows us to ask these kind of questions. What happens
safe,
if the robots?
You mean where it's
Sorry?
Safer to ask? You mean it's safer to ask in under the guise of science fiction than it might be to ask under the guise of religion?
Well, what I mean is, you know, in genre fiction, you can't, you know, there are certain limitations on the way things happen. Westerns have to happen a certain way. Romances have to happen a certain way. Detective novels have to happen a certain way. All science fiction begins with two words. What if?
Okay.
What if we create this race of robots? We beat them in a war. We send them away. They reinvent themselves, discover God, and come back for us. What if? What happens then? Right? What if we create, or you think about Blade Runner, you know, one
mm-hmm.
of my favorite films. You know, what happens if we create beings who are so much like us that we have to devise a special machine and a special test to tell the difference? And at what point does that difference stop mattering? What if? And this is where, you know, I try and push my students, because these are hard questions to ask, and they're hard questions to answer, because you can't just look at the film on the surface. It's what I call, oh, look, there's Jesus, now what? You know, you may have read things or seen things or talked to people who, when they see somebody throw their arms out, you know, in sort of a cruciform position, they go, well, that must be a Jesus figure. Well, you know what? Sometimes a dead guy is just a dead guy.
Right, right.
And if you've ever seen Blade Runner, I mean, one of the things that really gets under my skin about the way a lot of people interpret religion and science fiction is they sort of take their own theology and they just kind of map it onto the film.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, oh, look, that matches up with that, therefore. For example, in Blade Runner, there's one person who interpreted it. If you remember sort of the beginning of the film, Deckard is going to have dinner. He goes to this stand-up noodle shop in this sort of Chinatown, Japantown, Koreatown amalgam. And there's a dragon, like there's a neon dragon over the top of the noodle shop. And it's a Chinese dragon, and it's flickering and flashing. And he goes over, and the woman speaks to him in, you know, Chinese or Japanese or, you know, Pidgin Korean or whatever it is they're speaking. And it's an Oriental environment. And, well, this person said, well, this dragon obviously means that we are in a fallen Eden.
That was his interpretation.
Well, of course it was. But I go, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, you know what? You pay your money. You're entitled to interpret things any way you want. But it has to at least have some sort of conceptual resonance with the film. And simply pointing to something and going, oh, there's a dragon, that must mean we're in Eden. What I say is, you know, that's just not a very helpful interpretation. I think we can do better than that.
Yeah, that's too simplistic.
Of course, and wrong to boot. But then, or you've got at the end of the film, I mean, when I show Blade Runner to my classes, I mean, it's a hard film to watch. I mean, you know, it's not an easy film. It's dense. I mean, Ridley Scott is an absolute master at filling the screen with details that you can watch over and over and find something new,
mm-hmm.
right? He's an absolute genius at that.
Yeah.
And so he's at the end of the film. You know, so my students are watching it, right? And they're kind of going, because they have to write a paper on it, and they're watching it, and they're going, oh, God, what am I going to write about? There's no religion in this. Come on, man. You got, like, replicants running around, and it's dark, and things are blowing up. Come on, man. And then at the end, when Roy Batty, right, the replicant played by Rutger Hauer, who is a combat model, a soldier, he's having the final battle with Harrison Ford in what I just lovely named, you know, the Bradbury Building. And his lifespan is coming to an end because the replicants have a four-year lifespan. His life is ending, and he's starting to shut down. And he reaches down into the floor, and he pulls out this long hand-forged nail, and he shoves it through his palm. And the pain snaps him back to wakefulness, snaps him back to attention. And when I watch that scene, I watch all my students' heads, they just drop and they start scribbling away on their paper because what they see is, oh, he drove a nail through his palm. That means he's a Jesus figure. Thank God, now I have something to write about.
But
and I go, well,
simple,
okay.
Sure.
But let's consider what this being has done just in the past 10 minutes in the film. He has murdered the man who helped him find the man who created him. Then he has murdered the man who created him, committing either parricide, killing his father, or deicide, killing his God, depending on how you want to interpret it. Yeah, that's a hell of a Christ model for us to follow, don't you think? So that's why I say it, for me, one of the things that gets pretty tiresome is this sort of simplistic pointing out the Christ allegory and
right.
as though that answers some significant question. The
yeah,
other
without,
famous
without
example,
any reference
sorry?
To the without reference to the context of you know, what's been going on in the film, you know.
Exactly.
You just sort of,
or
yeah, you're just latching on to a familiar, you know, symbol.
Right, as well as what's going on in society. I mean, the other great example that I've written about, it's not in the book, but I wrote about it elsewhere, is the 1951 movie. Again, one of my favorites, The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When the alien Klaatu comes, and, you know, Gort the robot and all like that. Well,
yeah,
that comes out in 1950. Sorry?
Yeah, I remember it.
Yeah, that one comes out in 1951 and sort of does not bad. In fact, it was nominated for a Golden Globe the next year. It's still considered one of the American Film Institute's top 100 films of all time. And 30 years later, 1982, it's being revised. It's being shown in art theaters and, you know, places like that. And people start writing about it again. And they start layering over this, oh, the alien took the name Carpenter, and that was the profession Jesus was supposed to have. And, oh, when he fell, when he was shot, he kind of fell with his arms out, which is kind of like being on a cross. And Gort carries him into the ship, and which is kind of like going into a cave, and brings him back to life, which is kind of like resurrection. And then you read these articles sort of in order of the date that they appeared, and it becomes entirely obvious to me that people never actually watched the movie. What they did is they just kept quoting each other about how this is a Christian allegory, and it's nothing of the sort.
Yeah, with
if
a lot
anything,
of overreach. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, if anything, it's like what I call the Deuteronomic bargain, right? Moses getting ready to lead the Hebrew people into the so-called promised land, and he reads them the second law, and they're the second reading of the law, and there is this verse in it where he says, "Today I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Choose life so that you may live and prosper." That is to say, don't follow false idols, don't do bad things, or bad things will happen to you. Now,
right.
Consider the final sermon, and people talk about this as the final sermon, of Klaatu to the assembled scientists and world leaders. He doesn't say, you know, you all need to learn to get along and love each other. You all need to learn to just live happily and embrace your differences. No, what he says is, you know what, we've been watching you for a very long time. And we've discovered that you now have the ability to export your incredible aggression towards each other off-world. He says, we don't care what you do to each other on your own planet. That's up to you. But if you export your violence off-world, we will reduce your planet to a burned-out cinder. That's a quote.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hell of a Jesus message, don't you think? So
yes.
I look at that and I go, how can you possibly, if you've actually watched the film, come up with these ridiculous sort of theological overlays?
Right. Well, you're right.
So
they could,
I guess one of the things that I'm trying to do is say, in both books, is say, we have to ask better questions than that. And
yeah.
I do my best to offer some examples of what I think are better questions.
Well, Doug, I'm going to, you've made me feel like, gee, I need to go back and rewatch some of these films and some of these old
episodes.
Oh,
good, then I've done my job.
Yeah, some of these old X-Files episodes and things. I think maybe I'd like to read your book in its entirety and then watch the film with fresh eyes and, maybe start looking at these things a little bit differently.
Well, I appreciate that. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book. If it makes you want to do that, then I'm completely satisfied.
Well, Doug, it's been fun, but we're almost out of time now, and I see my second guest, Donna, is on the switchboard. Tell listeners, please, how they can find your book, and do you have a website or anything like that where they might be able to learn more about your two books or the subject at all?
The website is douglascowan.net. Cowan is C-O-W-A-N.
Okay.
So Douglas Cowan, all one word, .net. And both books are published by Baylor University Press. Your local bookstore can order them. Some may even stock them, or you can certainly get them at Amazon.
Well, it's been fun. We didn't get a chance to talk about everything. I wanted to find out what you had against Star Wars, and you called Avatar Pocahontas. But I guess we're just going to have to get the book, and we'll let that dangle out there like a carrot. What do you think?
Okay, sounds good.
All right. Well, listen. Thank you so much. It's been so much fun. I really enjoyed having you on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay. Good night.
Bye bye.
Bye bye. Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed Doug as much as I did. Just as a little tidbit there, we were talking about Avatar before we went live. And okay, hang on, let me see. Donna, are you there?
I'm here, hi.
Oh, hi, great, great. I'm glad you're there, Donna. Welcome back to the show. I want to just read your bio for folks who perhaps didn't hear you last time you were on, because it's been quite a while. So let me just do that real quick, and then we'll jump into our topic, A Woman's Guide to Power, Claim It, Embrace It, and Use It. So listeners, Donna Hennes is an internationally known, renowned urban shaman. She's an eco-ceremonialist, ritual expert, spiritual counselor, award-winning writer, popular speaker, and workshop leader. So many of us call her Mama Donna, as she is affectionately known, and she's the author of 4 books, including the award-winning The Queen of Myself. And she currently writes for the Huffington Post, BeliefNet, UPI Religion and Spirituality Forums, as well as publishing a monthly e-zine, The Queen's Chronicles. In addition to teaching and lecturing, she maintains a ritual practice and consultancy, working with individuals and groups to create personally relevant rituals for all of life's transitions. And we'll give it again later, but her websites are thequeenofmyself.com and donnahennes.net. DonnaHennes. So, Donna, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
So, what have you been up to these days? How is your Queen's teachings going? And I'm sure that's going to tie into the Woman's Guide to Power, I would imagine. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Well, it's amazing because we're now at the 7th birthday anniversary of The Queen of Myself, and it's hard to believe it's been out that long, and what's even harder to believe, although delightful to believe, is that it has maintained a position on Amazon in the top 100 books in the spirituality department for 7 years. And so,
well, congratulations. That's awesome.
It really is awesome, and it's just because there's so many incredible queens out there, midlife women who really want to step into their own sovereignty and take the reins of their own lives. And, of course, the next step is to reign in the big wide world.
Well, you know, as you're saying that, I can't help but think, Donna, about what's in the news right now. You know, Republicans trying to just pull women backwards. I mean, imagine we are still having conversations about contraception. I mean, what do you feel? I mean, how does that make you feel? Where does that what would the Queen say about that?
Well, the Queen would say, how dare you?
to the dungeon with you, to the rack.
You know, I'm horrified. The contraception thing is bad enough, but you know, there's a law that was just passed in Virginia that when a woman wants an abortion, she is forced, without her consent, in order to obtain an abortion, she has to undergo an internal, through the vagina, sonogram with this huge instrument to determine how many weeks she might be along in her pregnancy. This is rape. I'm sorry. I can't believe nobody's actually calling it what it is. And here we've been reading about some of the horrible things that the military government of Egypt has been doing, the so-called replacement government has been detaining women, and one of the things they do in prison is subject them to a virginity test. And, of course, once they're finished with that test, which you can only imagine too graphically, they're not a virgin any longer.
So do you think the whole idea behind that is really just to you know, encourage the women to just stay home and be good and not make any noise?
Well, I think encourage is too kind and sweet of a word. I think it's
coerce.
It's terrorism. it's just out and out blatant terrorism against women and against our bodies. You know, no matter what you think about the about abortion, I have never really heard people say that they're pro-abortion. They're pro-choice. They're pro every woman determining what happens to her own body, period. That's the end of the argument. And I can hardly speak. I'm just so horrified at this latest Virginia, I don't even know what to call it. It's obscene. It's obscene in the worst way.
Well, I mean, it seems like there's just been an onslaught they call it the war on women. And, I mean, and it feels like that's what it is. I mean, since Republicans took over so many Congresses last November, I mean, there's been more than 900 bills presented in Congresses across the country in one form or another. I mean, covering everything from, they can't, you know, do away with Roe versus Wade to, do away with abortion, but they can limit access. They can put you through a horrendous test like you described. I mean, some of these places are trying to make it harder for women to get divorced, trying to make it harder to get contraception. And, I mean, it's really unfathomable to me that this is going on, unless, Donna, I'd love your ideas on this. Do you think that this has gotten so out of hand, so outrageous, so overreaching, that in a way they might not even realize they are playing into a bigger picture scenario where they overreach so bad, like they did in Wisconsin with unions, that there's just this huge backlash, and maybe it will pave the way for real, revolution, evolution, the moral imperative, finally, you know, women's equal rights. I mean, I don't know. Am I just being too hopeful and naive, or do you have any thoughts?
Well, I certainly hope you're right, you know, and I think that I guess it's better to think that way, because at least there's some hope behind it instead of adding more negative energy to the negative energy. But I really am appalled, and I just got an email today from Emily's List with a photograph in it that yesterday, I believe it was, in Congress, somebody, and I don't remember who, but somebody called this panel of men to testify on women's rights to contraception. There were six clergymen, not one of whom was even a doctor, and not one woman.
Well, you know, I actually saw that myself on the news. I don't know if it was yesterday or today, but yeah, there were some Democratic congresswomen up in arms. Some of them boycotted the hearing. Others held their feet to the fire and said, where are the women? Where is the other side of this equation? And, you know, one of them rightly said they are treating women like chattel, and they, you know, they can't believe that this is happening in our lifetime. It's unthinkable. And I just wish all women everywhere knew this was going on, because I think too often, at least I hear it said, I don't think I'm pulling this out of the air, too often, you know, I've heard women say, well, I vote Republican because that's what my dad did or my mother did. Well, you know, these are not your mom and dad's Republicans. These are extremists who sincerely want to thwart women's rights. It's unfathomable how blatant they are about it. It's unfathomable to me that there's not a bigger stink going on about it. I mean, women should be in the street, for heaven's sake.
Absolutely. I agree. And what's so ironic, so horribly ironic, is, you know, this huge hate campaign against Islam and the Islamization, the threatened Islamization of our country. And here, as far as I can see, there's really no difference in terms of what the Christian right is doing.
Well, I agree with you. I think terrorism is terrorism, whether it's fundamentalist Islam or fundamentalist Christianity. And I honestly think there's an agenda behind that. You know, my personal opinion is it's let's hate the Muslims because then it'll make it easier to get the country, ginned up to go to war with Iran. I really think that that's what's behind it, quite frankly.
I'm sure you're probably right. I don't know. I don't really know, but it's kind of come out of left field. And I think partially why we're not having such a huge outcry is I think we're dumbfounded. We can't even believe this is happening.
Well, I wonder if it's that, or I wonder if it might also be that, you know, the people who think like we do, we say to ourselves, oh, that can't possibly be many people that think like that. They must really be this fringe minority. But I wonder, you know, I quite frankly wonder, when you have Fox News going at it 24/7, I mean, I know smart people who really think we have to worry about Sharia law in the United States. You know, they really, you know, don't get it that there are other laws that would prevent, you know, Sharia law from ever taking hold here, and we would never have to worry about it. But, you know, Fox News is doing its job of creating this fear and, this divisiveness in creating these enemies where enemies don't even really exist. And, it's really scary, and it really bugs me that more people aren't on the left outraged. You know, the right is always screaming and standing up and stomping their feet. Even when there's nothing to stand up and scream and stomp their feet about, we have lots to stand up and stomp our feet about. But you know what? We're just too nice. I mean, I don't know. It feels like that, you know. And maybe I have a warped perspective. I don't know, but that's how it seems to be.
Well, you know, I would not like to live under Sharia law. I agree. However, I do not want to live under biblical law either.
Exactly.
And I don't see a difference.
Well, yeah, quite frankly, you know, you just trade one evil for another evil. We're getting a little off track here, but going back to tying this back to women's power, it's annoying to me, too, when women are complicit in their oppression or they abdicate their responsibility and they go along with this and they become handmaidens of the patriarchy, and rather than fighting against this, you know, they're on their side. I mean, that, you know, how does that, if at all, you know, play into your ideas, Donna, about women's power? I mean, do you really think that's women's power, or what is that?
Well, I think power is a problem for women. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I heard some very strange sound on my end. It sounded like a click off. Sorry. A couple of years ago, I was doing a workshop about the Queen of Myself at the Omega Institute here on the East Coast. And I was saying that here in the United States alone, there are something like 60 million women in our mid-years. And I was saying, if only we realized how much power we had, and if only we used it, we could completely change everything.
Yes.
And this woman raised her hand and said, and if only we weren't afraid of it. And that was a real aha moment for me, because I knew she wasn't just talking about herself. This was a very true statement. And that's what got me started on thinking about women and power and empowerment, and how can we deal with power in a different way, and how can we change our thinking about power before it's too late, because we obviously need to step up.
Well, so let's start at the beginning then, because, you know, definitions are everything. When you say power...
Power is neutral. Power is not bad. Power is not good. Power is not evil. It's not positive. Electricity is power. Charisma is power. A hurricane is power. So power is not a frightening thing. It's intention that's frightening. It's what we do or don't do with power. We live in a culture that looks at power as power over. Power by domination, power by oppression, power by intimidation, power by by terrorism, power by violence. And when I think of power, and I think when a lot of enlightened women think about power, and certainly feminist women think about power, we're thinking about empowerment, the power that rises from within us, the power of our own center and our own being and our own purpose and passion. To me, that's the power that I'm interested in. I'm going to say once again, I think I'm talking into blank air. And since I'm not hearing back from you, I'm kind of assuming that that's the case, and I don't know what to do about it. So I guess I should just keep talking. I don't know. In case you can hear me, you can call me back on 718-857-2247, which is a second line here. So the power that women are afraid of is that violent kind of power, is that oppressive kind of power. And we're afraid of it for good reason, because we've been victimized by it as a group for millennia, and unfortunately as individuals. The latest statistics is that 1 out of 2 women have been sexually abused, which is really hard to understand and relate to, but apparently it's true. So we need the queen of myself was really about the empowerment of women as individuals, about coming into our power as midlife women, as beginning to see ourselves as being powerful, and as taking power in our own realm, being the determining agent of our own lives and the author of our own scripts and our own present and future. The last chapter in the book is called Empress Energy, which looks at the Empress as a kind of an enlargement of the Queen, a Queen with a bigger realm. So the idea is that hopefully we can put nice round fannies on all 60 million thrones. And once all these women are empowered, that we can gather together.
Hear me? And I don't know what's happened with the connection tonight. It's crazy. We had a little bit of trouble in the very beginning with my first guest. It seemed like the sound dropped out, but we were able to continue. So anyway, I'm actually still on the air talking to you on the other line. So what I'm going to suggest you do is just dial back into the show. I'm going to play a little bit of music, you know, for about 30 seconds to give you time to dial back in. And I apologize. I don't know what the technical difficulties are tonight. I've never had this happen before. Okay, yeah, maybe that is what it is. Okay, so we'll wait for you. Thank you. Bye-bye. Well, listeners, like I said, I don't know what it is tonight. Maybe we're in retrograde or something like that. Donna just said maybe it's the Mars energies. So we're going to just listen to a little bit of Breath of Life by Leah Scallion. I know you could hear Donna talking about the Queen and her book, and she'll be back in just a minute. Oh, actually, I think there she is now.
Hi,
there you are. Can you hear me now?
I can. Thanks.
Oh, good. Let's hope it doesn't happen again, Donna. But if you can't hear me anymore, I guess just call back in again. Okay.
Okay.
But we heard everything you said. And you were brilliant. Even though I'm sure that must have felt horribly awkward, you know, wondering if there was anybody on the other end.
Well, it was a little weird. It was like singing in the shower or something.
Well, your voice was beautiful. Well, so let's talk a little bit about, all right, so we're talking about women fearing their power, but why is it if they fear their own power, they like powerful men?
Ah, that's the question. That's a good question. I think that is really biologic, and it probably goes all the way back to Neolithic times when, you know, we chose a mate to reproduce with, we would choose the one who had the most powerful sperm so that our baby would survive. And that's just, if you watch any of these animal programs or National Geographic, and every time you see rams or male deers, bucks, having these fights, they're fighting for the right to reproduce. That
That's
nature
true.
Wants the strongest sperm to survive. So that women have always been attracted to powerful men, whether they're the best hunter or the best trapper or the best stockbroker or the best hockey player or the best provider, because during that time of pregnancy and nursing, women are vulnerable, and certainly their baby is. So I really think that is where it comes from, that we needed to find a powerful man, literally for protection.
So it's biological.
I really think so. Of course, it's not necessary anymore.
Right, absolutely. Well, all right, so let's think about this. Okay, so we want women to understand that when we talk about power, that power is not a bad thing. We're talking about empowerment.
Yes.
But how do we start, you know, shifting the woman? Let me just tell you a little story real quick. I was talking to a lovely woman from Texas, some Christian religion, I'm not sure which one now, but she was telling me how excited she was. Her and her girlfriends had scheduled a tea time with their minister, and they couldn't wait to have tea time with the minister, because if he liked their ideas, gee, maybe they'd be able to institute them in their parish. And I wanted to just shake her and say, girl, you know, don't wait for this guy to give you permission to do what you want to do. Just do it, you know. Do you think it's conditioning? Do you think it's fear of our own power? Do you think, how do we shift somebody like that into taking the reins, you know, and making, you know, and helping them to know that it's okay?
Well, for that, I really do have to refer you back to the Queen and Myself, because that really is what that book is about, is how to become powerful, how to recognize the power that we have and to start stepping into it. And in terms of why we're afraid of that, I think a lot of it is conditioning. You know, I remember when I was dating as a teenager, I'd go out and my mother would say, "Now, don't talk too much. Ask him a lot of questions. Don't be too smart. Boys don't like smart girls." And, of course, that's not true. Any man who is worthy to be with us is better like smart women.
Yeah, they want a partner.
Exactly. And from the male point of view, it's hard enough to be a man in this world. You don't want a little pull toy that you have to pull behind you and make all the decisions for everybody.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, you think men, well, I'm sure there, I mean, I know there are a lot of men out there who would like to be able to have somebody to lean on and know that they could count on, and not just for washing the clothes and cooking the dinner, you know.
Right, and your head against and really have a, you know, somebody to stand up to and who will stand up to you and to have an equal human being at the other end.
Absolutely. Well, and, you know, forgive me, I'm not one to, you know, be politically correct sometimes. You know, I just sort of say it because, you know, I think that's what we should do. You know, it doesn't always pay to be polite. But don't you think, Donna, some women have taken a back seat simply because it's easier? You know, they would rather just let the guy take care of everything. You know, they do abdicate their responsibility. I mean, it's partly our own fault. In some cases at least?
Sure, sure. In some cases. I think, though, in general, there's more to it than that. I think we really have been conditioned to, A, be good girls, to be nice, not to make waves, not to ask for too much. My mother always told me when I was a date, I should read the right side of the menu first and always order the cheapest thing on the menu, you know, whether I liked it or not. So, you know, we've been raised kind of like, who do you think you are?
Yeah.
So we have not been raised. I think that's very different today. Because I think women who were raised the way I was, for sure, and women of a certain age, have really changed that kind of parenting model and have done a much better job with their own children, their own daughters.
Well, let's hope so.
Yes, exactly.
Well, if you had to distinguish how women use power differently, what's that distinction?
Well, actually, I want to go back to that previous question about
Sure. Women
abdicating.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that it's it, but I think that it has to do also with stepping back a little bit. Why we as, you know, generically are attracted to power. Unfortunately, more so than being attracted to niceness, for example. But men are conditioned to be successful no matter what. Men have a fear of failure. And that's because they want to be loved. If women are looking for strong men, and a man who, whatever, can't support himself or can't fight a proper battle or can't get along well in whatever universe he lives in, he's afraid that nobody will love him. A woman at Harvard, a psychologist at Harvard, did a test on women and discovered that to the same degree that men are afraid of failure, women are afraid of success for the exact same reason. They're afraid that they won't be loved
by men because they would see men would. Do you think it's because they think men will see them as competition or not womanly, you know, too masculine?
Both, yes, both of those. But I think that a woman's biggest fear, beyond not being loved by a male is not being loved by women. Because women, as much as I love women and I love groups of women, and I you know, I'm a womanist for, you know, on every issue. But women can be very competitive with each other and very backbiting with each other. I think going back to feeling like you have to compete either for the few good men or the few good jobs or the few, you know, for the little piece of a pie that is open to us.
Right, right.
And I can remember back in, I guess it was the early 70s, I was in one of the first consciousness-raising groups. And, oh, I just loved it. It changed my whole life. I just loved these group of women, which was so interesting because we were all, it was multicultural, multiracial, multi-class. We were from all over the place. And we all had the same issues. And it was really amazing. And we were very, very supportive to each other in all kinds of, not just emotional ways, but actually physical and concrete, practical ways, as long as we were all victims together. And as soon as somebody actually started to succeed in doing what it was that she had always wanted to do, and now she could finally get the courage together to do it, we'd be back at, who do you think you are?
Right. Yeah.
I remember people saying about Gloria Steinem, who does she think she is?
Yeah. Yeah, what is that old saying, you know, about the lobster pot? When one is crawling out, they pull you back down in the boiling water.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I find that absolutely horrifying, and I think it is beginning to change. But you can still see, remnants of that.
Oh, yeah.
And I read something that Oprah wrote, and I'm a very, you know, hot and cold about Oprah. I'm not a total fan. But she said the most frightening, scary, sad thing that I think I've ever read a woman say. And she said, the hard part of being successful is finding somebody to be glad for you.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's heartbreaking.
Well, it is. It is because, you know, when it gets to the point where your friends are not your peers anymore and they see you as someone to be jealous of, it's tough to take, you know, because it manifests in all sorts of ugly ways. You know, suddenly people you knew for 10 years just don't treat you the same anymore.
Exactly. And as far as you're concerned, you would love to still be friends with them.
Sure. I mean, you're still the same person.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, look, I'll be totally honest with you. You know, people who would not talk to me before I wrote my first book were suddenly my best friend, you know, a week later after they found out I had a published book. And you know, on the flip side of the coin, you know, people who are my good friends suddenly treated me differently. I know exactly what you're talking about. And I was still the same person as I was before and after the book, you know?
Exactly. The most famous woman in the world still wants to be friends with her junior high school girlfriends.
Yeah, yeah, but absolutely.
They are looking at themselves through the mirror of her. And it's not so much that they're jealous of her. I think it's more about, well, why didn't I? Why couldn't I? Why,
yeah.
You know, what's wrong? You know, it's really having to face the fact that maybe you didn't have as much determination or as much discipline or as much, or maybe support, maybe as much help, whatever.
Right,
but,
right.
But it's kind of putting yourself down in a certain kind of way.
But, you know, I wonder if women realize that. I wonder as they're going through that shift from turning someone from their friend to their adversary, and I'm not sure if that's exactly the right word to use, but in this context, you know, if they're understanding that angst they're feeling inside is them feeling their own shortcomings. I don't know if they always, examine that and reflect on it, because if they did, I don't think they would make the woman who has accomplished something the enemy,
right.
You know?
Right. I agree. But I think that that's a reason that women are afraid of success.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what looks like sliding by.
So in your Queen's book or in any of your teachings, do you have any tips to help women recognize this and maybe get beyond it so that we can be that force you talked about at the top of the conversation? You know, imagine what we could do if we actually stood shoulder to shoulder.
That's right. Well, I think it's not so much, the answer isn't so much how we treat others, but it really comes down to the basics of how we treat ourselves and how we think about ourselves. And it really has to start in self-love. And out of self-love comes self-esteem and self-acknowledgement and so on. But it really has to start there. You know, we've all been raised on one or another version of the golden rule. You know, love thy neighbor as thyself. Do unto others as blah, blah, blah. And I discovered this website, and I'm going to say it, but I think it's not quite right, goldenrule.com, but I think there's something else in there. And it is the golden rule in every single spiritual tradition, from Zoroastrian to Zen to Zulu to Zuni. It's amazing. And they're all, of course, exactly the same. The words, of course, are different, but the sentiment is exactly the same. Do unto others, love thy neighbor as thyself. There's not one that says, love thy neighbor more than thyself.
Right.
So the whole premise of everything we've ever been taught about how to be a good person is based on self-love. That it's not selfish, and it's not diva-esque, and it's not who does she think she is, but to really see ourselves as being worthy makes every difference in the world. Because if we are worthy, then we can ask for what we need, we can make requests, we can make demands. We can make rules. We can make boundaries if we believe we deserve to be treated with respect and with honor. And I think that's really, I think that's the absolute bottom line of how to find that power in yourself. And then, of course, once we're individually empowered, how can we join with other women without being jealous of them and competing with them to be the most empowered or whatever. And that's a good question. But I think that it goes back again to self-love, because if you love yourself, then nobody else is a threat.
Right. Well, and maybe even a good rule of thumb is, and I don't know if this is possible, but, you know, don't compare yourself to other people.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, there's, you know, none of our circumstances are exactly right. You're never really comparing apples to apples anyway, you know?
Exactly. And it's dangerous to be envious, because you don't know. You don't know what that person is dealing with.
Yeah.
In closed doors. You might not want to trade places with her.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at people who have all the money in the world, have all the success, and you know what? They're not happy. You know, so it doesn't mean that the grass is greener on the other side. You know, you may really have it better, even though you didn't publish that book, or you don't feel comfortable standing in front of the room and you want to hide behind the piano.
Well, I think that's the goal, is to be comfortable in ourselves, in our center, in our gut, and then to be able, then you can be comfortable with anybody.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, we probably have about 10 or 15 minutes left, maybe, Donna. What do you think would be the most important points to get into? You know, how women use power differently, or, you know, where do you want to take the conversation? What do you think would be most helpful for women?
Well, I think that is interesting. I think we're beginning to get a glimpse of how we might use power differently. And It's really interesting. Actually, I read an article from, I believe it's the Harvard Business Newsletter, or, you know, there's probably a name for it, but it was from the Harvard Business School, a whole issue on what they termed soft power, meaning that at the end of the day, women are much more suited to be in leadership positions than men are.
And why is that?
Well, for a lot of reasons. First of all, we tend to be more stable. I know that that's the argument against us, especially for bleeding women. And, you know, oh, my gosh, you know, they're going to be wacko a few days every month. You can't count on them. But at the end of the day, when you think of what women have to do, and how they hold down so many forts at once, we really are very dependable because so much depends on us. I remember one of my favorite books is Doris Lessing's A Summer Before the Dark, where she is dealing with a woman going through her midlife rebirth. And she was saying that any woman who has run a household is totally capable and qualified to run a Fortune 500 corporation, that it's a matter of organization and planning and scheduling, and mediating and, you know, every skill that a mother has. So I thought that was really interesting. And also, women are more likely to seek common ground, more likely to seek consensus versus bullying somebody into submission.
Well, and I think I read somewhere, too, a UCLA study where women sort of see the big picture, you know, how their actions are going to affect others, and they care about it, as opposed to maybe looking at things in a much more linear, almost selfish way.
Right, exactly. And so all that. And I, you know, and there are a lot of examples of this. I had a personal example not too long ago. I opened a second bank account at my local branch, and it was a very common, easy, simple transaction. 2 days later, I got a handwritten card in the mail from the manager of the bank thanking me for my business, and if I ever need anything, she would be there for me. I couldn't
believe
it.
Woman's touch. There you go.
You know, I went to the bank. I walked right over there, and I gave her a queen book, and I said, "This is extraordinary. You have a customer for life." And all it cost was 44 cents. And she said that is what she tells all of her employees, that it's that personal touch that makes a customer loyal, or that makes a shopper a customer or whatever. And I could not imagine in 500 million years getting a handwritten note from a male manager of a bank.
Yeah,
for my piddly little business.
Right, absolutely.
So that's an example from real life of how we can do business differently. And I thought that was really interesting. And also, it's interesting to look at the heads of state around the world who are women. There are more than there ever have been. Unfortunately, they're not nearly enough, but we are gaining a little bit of ground. And some of the examples are absolutely stunning, like Sirleaf, who is the president of Liberia. She just got a Nobel Peace Prize, actually, with another amazing woman in Liberia. And when she was running for office, her whole platform and the way she positioned herself as the mother of this country, and that if one person is hungry, this country is a failure. If one person doesn't have a place to sleep, then this country is a failure. I've never heard anybody else in politics talk quite in those terms. It was very personal.
Wow.
And we have to look out for each other. It wasn't this party and this idiot and that idiot. And
yeah.
It was so sweet. And, of course, she was elected with a big margin.
Can you imagine if a politician talked like that here? I mean, you know, you'd start to hear, first thing you'd hear out of their mouth was, oh, they're socialist.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Well, Kucinich is the closest person in this country who kind of talks like that. And,
yeah.
And you know, he's made out to be a flaming idiot.
A kook. Yeah, he's a kook.
And he's
yeah.
a vegan, too. Oh, my gosh, he's really out of it. So the other president, she was the president of Chile. She just came out of office. And for the moment, I'm forgetting her name, which is really too bad because she's a remarkable woman. Her father was a general in the army of Chile. And then when Pinochet took power, her father was assassinated. And she and her mother were both imprisoned, raped, tortured, the whole thing. She is absolutely the opposite of what you would consider to be an acceptable woman in Chile, which is a Catholic country and an economically capitalist country. She is a single mother. She was a medical doctor, is a medical doctor, but was obviously not practicing. And she, when she was campaigning, she was totally out and above board about who she was and what she believed in. And she would say, this is who I am. This is what I believe in. And if you don't agree with me, vote for him.
Mm-hmm.
He'll represent you much better than I will.
Right.
And here, a politician has to take a poll to find out what people want to hear so he knows what to say.
Right, right. It's a shame, isn't it?
Who they really are and what they really believe in. They only want to be elected.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She was very, and you know, plus she called herself an atheist. And as I said, she was a single mother. And the whole thing, well, she was elected by a landslide.
Wow.
And her inauguration address was extraordinary. It just happened that her inauguration happened while Pinochet was on trial for crimes against humanity.
What great timing.
It was amazing. And she said, this is not a time for hate and retribution. This is a time for reconciliation and, dare I say, love, unquote.
Well, and, you know, and any time you hear somebody like that talking, anybody talking like that here in the United States, you know, you've got the right who says they're weak, you know.
Exactly. Love is a four-letter word, how you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody
yeah,
would be elected saying, I love, well, maybe I love this country, but not I love the people in it, and I love.
Yeah.
I love freedom, but she was absolutely extraordinary. And Angela Merkel, who is not the most liberal, radical person in the world, just disengaged all the nuclear power plants in Germany.
Mm, good
after
for her.
Fukushima, and declared Germany a nuclear-free zone. And the only two countries in the world that are nuclear-free zones are Germany and New Zealand, both of which are run by women.
Wow. Well, you know, and you're making me think about Margaret Thatcher. I mean, I just watched Iron Lady with Meryl Streep.
Right.
And, you know, and you were seeing in the backdrop, you know, she was part of the conservative government. And one of the lines in the movie, you know, under her leadership, the rich got richer and the poor got poorer, and her car was mobbed when she would drive down the street because She apparently, under her leadership, so many people suffered. And it seems like that's a different type of woman than these women you're describing today, you know?
Well, it's the old school. It's the woman like Golda Meir and Indira Gandhi and so on. It took a certain kind of woman to be able to be successful. It was like back in the 70s, the first women who were breaking into big law firms and the stock market and so on wore those horrible suits and those stupid floppy bow ties to prove that they were powerful.
Right.
And now the CEO of PepsiCo is an East Indian woman who wears saris.
So what do you think shifted, Donna, that women can, this sounds simple to say, but women can act like women now and not like men. And, I mean, not that, at least here in the United States, I mean, we don't have a lot of leadership in, you know, academia, our corporate culture or politics. I mean, we have less than 20%. But in other parts of the country, it's different. I mean, I think in the Netherlands, they have a 40% solution where they have to have at least 40% representation of women on their boards and things like that. Do you think it's happened through government legislation or just the women's movement? I mean, do you have any sense of how it shifted away from the Margaret Thatchers to, you know, what we're seeing maybe now breaking through?
Well, I think so much has changed in the culture, the sexual revolution, the gay revolution, the drug, sex, and rock and roll revolution. There's more possibility of being, and this is changing now, actually, because now there's a kind of a resurgence back to 1950s thinking. But there was a period of time where there was more freedom, and this is how we started the conversation. There's a real movement now to divest us of that freedom, and there are not going to be so many women elected to office if I don't know. I mean, even in the last campaign, Hillary, who might well have been more qualified and certainly did have some good ideas and so on. And actually, I supported Hillary until the end when, of course, I definitely supported Obama over McCain. But she had her foot in that old school. And then came along these two right-wing women, both of whom were idiots, but were very feminine,
mm-hmm.
and still had the support of plenty of men.
Yeah.
Who were willing to see her as the leader of the free world. It's sort of a laughable concept, but I think that's sort of interesting. They didn't feel that they had to wear pants. They didn't feel that they had to hide their motherhood. As a matter of fact, both of them used it to advantage.
Yes, yes.
And the only time that Hillary really surged in popularity was the time that she was weepy, that time in New Hampshire. And I don't remember what brought it on, but she kind of got all teary, and her popularity spiked.
Yes, yeah, I remember.
So, I don't know.
It's an interesting
really
psychology. It's an interesting psychology. I wonder what a psychologist would make of it. I mean, I'm sure somebody's thought about it, or maybe there's even some articles out there written about it, you know?
I would imagine so, and I'm going to certainly look for them. But what I'm noticing just in myself in a very personal way is that as I am aging, well, when I do these workshops about the queen and women and being empowered and so on, a very common fear that comes up all the time is women saying that they feel either that they already are or that they're afraid that they will become invisible. That once our use is over, our use as reproductive machines and sexual machines is over, that nobody will just be invisible and fade into the background. And I'm finding it to be absolutely the other way around. It's fascinating to me. And I think that, I get such respect and kindness all the time from total strangers, from men, from young men, from older men, from men my same age. And I think that there is something to be said, especially now when the world is so terrifying, there's something to be said about a psychological, and I'm not a psychologist, but it seems to be this need for a mature female, I won't say leader in my case, but a mature female presence,
mm-hmm.
with a capital P.
It's like nurturing and comforting, you know.
Well,
maybe
but also tough love.
Yeah.
Not all sweet. Not all sweet. It's like somebody to tell them what it is and what to do, and let's get this thing organized, you know.
Yeah. No, I get that. I get that. You know, it's like they're valuing that over the youth and the sexuality now.
I'm really feeling that a lot. Like, feeling it enough to really notice it and try to analyze it.
Right. Well, that's good. That's a positive trend.
I mean, I'm really enjoying it. But I have to say, going back to the way we started this conversation, it's like at one point my literary agent said to me that, you know, Barnes & Noble has started their own publishing arm, as has Amazon, and they're really kind of cutting out publishers now. Publishing is just a kind of a dying concern unless they figure out a new way to be. And she said to me once, if they could get rid of the authors, they would be really happy. And I think that you can apply that to how this culture is, what that war on women is. If you could just get babies, and hey, let's just adopt them from China, you right?
Mm-hmm.
And have an inflatable doll. What do we even need them for?
Right. Yeah, it's like a too high maintenance, you know, not worth the trouble.
Yeah, they're always wanting things, and, you know. Like,
or making demands, or, you know, expecting us to be better. Or
how dare they? Who do they think they are? It really comes back to that. So our job is to know who we think we are. And we don't have to think it. We know it. We know who we are, and we know what we know, especially as we get older. We know what we know.
And step into
no
that empowerment. Yeah, you know what? I think what you were just saying is we make ourselves indispensable. You know, we make ourselves indispensable because, you know, we make them realize that, you know, just how much they need us, so that they don't, you know, consider us nothing but incubators and chattel and, you know, a better version of a blow-up doll, you know. Interesting. Lots to think about here, Donna, and unfortunately we're running out of time.
Right.
So we'll have to keep delving into this. Wouldn't this make a wonderful woman's salon?
Yes.
You know? I challenge all my listeners out there, get together with your women friends, start a circle and talk about this. You know, get Mama Donna's book, The Queen of Herself, and, you know, maybe use that as, you know, the springboard for, you know, a book circle or a book club or salon or something.
We need every one of us, and obviously we're we're not there yet. And I think in the last couple of years, I've been sensing that people are absolutely paralyzed with fear and disbelief at how out of control everything seems to be, from the economy to these crazy weather patterns to terrorism to this idiotic political game that we're in the middle of now. And I thought of it as some kind of a spiritual catatonia, that we're just paralyzed. And I think that you were saying, well, why aren't we out there? And I think it's time to wake up and look around and get out there and occupy our place, take up space.
No, I agree. I've been waiting patiently to see Occupy, Wall Street and all the different hundreds of groups across the world, maybe it's been thousands of groups, to see how they're going to come back after the winter.
Right.
And I think, there needs to be, like Emily's List and, these women's groups. I mean, I think if the Republicans keep pushing the envelope the way they're doing it, they're going to have a backlash at the polls like they have never thought could happen. I mean, look what's happening to Scott Walker in Wisconsin,
Right.
I can only hope, I hope we women wake up and, talk to our friends and make sure we don't let our friends vote Republican. Because seriously, I mean, it's really scary where the country could go, quite frankly. Really scary for the poor, for women, for gays. It's unbelievable. And I think it's fear behind it all. I think it's fear that's driving this intolerance. But who knows? It may just be power. It may just be power.
Well, and the powers that be at the moment are, at this point, I think, realizing that they have to take draconian measures to hold on to that power, because there is, it might seem like nothing is happening, but I think that there really is an insurgence right now of people who are standing up, and it's trade unions, and it is students, and it's going to be women very shortly, because you're right, it's too important. And,
yeah.
And I think that's what we're seeing now. We're seeing the death throes of a way of being, and we now have to invent the new way, because it doesn't exist yet.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like they have their boot on our throat and their hand at our throat, because they're just trying to hold on desperately. And their time has come and gone. They're the dinosaurs. They are not the future.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, Donna, we're about ready to go off the air here, but I want to thank you and make sure, please mention your websites again and the name of your book so listeners can find you and your wonderful work.
Thanks. Thanks so much. You can look at www.donna, D-O-N-N-A, Hennes, Hennes.net, for all manners of ritual, ceremonial, spiritual work, and to thequeenofmyself.com. And I really urge you to go to that website. You can get the book, The Queen of Myself, but you can also sign up for a free subscription to the monthly e-zine, The Queen's Chronicles, that keeps us connected to our power on an ongoing basis.
And when your Huffington Post articles come out, definitely support them, too, by hitting that like button.
Oh, thank you.
Well, Donna, thank you so very much for your work in the world. It makes me feel good knowing you're out there.
And I feel exactly the same way about you. So let's just keep talking.
Absolutely. All right. Well, good night, and you have a wonderful weekend.
You too, Karen. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, listeners, thank you for tuning in. We only have about 30 seconds left, but I want to thank you for being with me tonight, and please tune in next week. I'm going to be talking to Professor Greg Garrett. We're going to be talking about the spirituality behind the Harry Potter series. And I'll also have Emmanuel Etier on the air with me. He is the producer of the upcoming film called Femme. I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing both of these fine gentlemen. So good night, listeners, and until next week, you have a great weekend, and may Goddess embrace you in her golden wings. Good night.